Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The newest installment in the New York Times best-selling series of tales of America's most notorious criminals and the crimes that shape the places we call home. This time you'll have no better guide through the darkest side of Iowa than Catherine Ramsland, one of America's most legendary true crime authors and researchers. Dr. Ramsland is a Wall Street Journal best-selling author and one of my favorite authors in any genre. She digs in deep and uncovers things that others before her have simply missed. With each story, she gives readers a look deep into the heart of darkness, Iowa style. A parent-murdering teen, an axe-wielding serial killer, a school shooting on campus, killer brothers posing as police, and many more notorious Iowa criminals. The book they're featuring this evening is Heartless, Notorious USA, Iowa, with my special guest, journalist and author, Professor Catherine Ramsland. Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Catherine Ramsland.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Good to
Thank
be here
you.
Again.
Thank you very much for joining us once again with this very interesting collection called Heartless. Let's get right into this because we won't have the time to cover all of these stories, but we have, it's amazing some of these stories sound so similar, but we've never heard of these ones in particular. Let's tell us how you came to selecting the stories for this collection called Heartless.
Well, first, the Heartless is strictly about Iowa, and that Iowa is part of a trilogy that I called Heartland Horrors, and the trilogy is part of a larger project that crime writer Greg Olson is sort of steering. I've done at least 13 of these now, of 13 different states. And so he wants to have crime stories for each state, and he tends to package them three or four together under themes. So that was the first thing, is just to get a theme. This package is Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. So that's, you know, the heartland, and that's partly right. What led to the title, and also the kinds of crimes that I selected. I already knew Villisca because I'd done a lot of work on that one with the actual the place that runs the tourist industry there in Villisca, Iowa. So I already knew about that one, and I knew that John Wayne Gacy, a serial killer, had some associations, and actually a number of serial killers have associations with Iowa. And then from there, I started looking for other ones that I thought would be intriguing. Like there's a haunted gravestone one, and there are a few that are kind of classic love triangle gone bad types of stories. But they definitely represent the sense of being in the Midwest, and especially, you know, the deep Midwest, where, like, you know, where sometimes very hard to exist, where people can be in isolation, where legends grow up around certain incidents, sometimes ghost stories, sometimes stories about how murders happened, unsolved murders and whatnot. So there's a special way that I think Midwesterners tend to tell stories and then pass them along, and I wanted to capture that kind of thing for Iowa.
Let's just go through maybe just a brief description of the story, starting with Mystery Boy, and before we delve into a couple specific stories that we're going to talk about this evening.
Well, the mystery boy actually came from, I was driving across from Michigan, actually, another Midwestern state. I was driving there, and I was listening to a podcast called Criminal, and they had mentioned the unique aspect of this story, being that an 11-year-old boy had murdered his parents and went to prison, but had the wherewithal to figure out how to craft appeals and to get out of prison, and actually end up doing very well for himself. So that was a really interesting story, and it was Iowa. So for me, that absolutely went into the collection because it's such a unique story. You don't hear about 11-year-olds not only killing their families. I mean, I have heard of that a couple of other times, but you don't hear about somebody who has the kind of personality and the ability to teach himself things about the law and politics and whatnot and write these appeals for himself, and he won people over. I thought that was a really interesting story. Some of the others, there's a mass murder on a campus ground. There's a slaughter of some kids in sort of a hiking area that was pretty famous. Let's see, you say something about every single one of them, or how do you want to do this?
Well, we could talk about some of them specifically. I think, like, we talked about the Villisca, Iowa, and you said you had done some research before on this, and this is a particularly horrifying story. So maybe we can talk about June 12, 1912 in Villisca.
Okay, well, when I was writing for the Crime Library, which was part of Court TV when Court TV was around, the people at Villisca, which is currently run as a sort of a museum, and some you can pay to stay overnight if you're a ghost hunter type of person who wants to experience the vibes, they had actually contacted my editor at the Crime Library and wanted a piece done. So they gave me a lot of materials to work with, and the point was, it remains unsolved, although there are certainly people who believe it's solved because they have their own theories, which I mentioned in my rendering. It is currently unsolved, and although the theories are out there, like Jack the Ripper, you know, there's over 300 people named for Jack the Ripper, and yet that is still not solved. But in the minds of the people who have their theories, it's solved. I wasn't convinced by any of the theories thus far, so to my mind, this still remains a really creepy murder where not just a family of six, but two young girls who were doing a sleepover with their friends were also slaughtered in this house by one person, apparently with an axe, who had some peculiar habits, like covering over the windows, and there was a hunk of bacon sitting out, and the lamp, the glass cover for the lamps they were using, seemed to have been placed in an odd place, and there were just a number of strange elements to this crime, and also they didn't necessarily have any enemies, and even if the father might have, because he was a well-to-do man and he had a rival in business and maybe he had some enemies, but why would you slaughter the whole family over something like that? So it's really a mystery. There was some sense that whoever had done this might have been spying on them from their own barn, because it looked like there was an indentation in the hay and a little peephole that would have given this person some pretty good sense of their movements. But it really wasn't about watching their movements and learning their routines and whatnot. He happened to come in very late at night on a Sunday after they'd all been to church for a special church program for the kids and slaughtered them. So for all we know, that was just simply, luck. He or they might or might not be related to a number of other axe murders in neighboring states over a few years. that, and some of them had behavioral similarities, such as the glass cover on the lamp and the way the house is entered and things like that. So possibly, and even probably, I would say Villisca wasn't an isolated incident, probably has some relationship to a few of those. Does it have a relationship to 50 or 60 or 200? No, it doesn't, but people have certainly made it stretch, you know, to that many.
You write about something very, very interesting that I've never read before, a superstition that something that happened in death involving the retina and the superstition. Please explain this.
During a certain period of time, there was a notion that, are you talking about the image left on the eye?
Yes.
That's what you mean? There was a certain idea that if people saw their killer coming at them, that as they were dying, the retina would retain the killer's image. And so what needed to be done, and they did believe that one of the, although the rest seemed to have been killed in their sleep, one of the girls appeared to have struggled a bit, and there looked to be a, you know, the potential there for some sexual assault or molestation. And if she had her eyes open and as she was dying, the idea was that we could somehow get the image of the killer off her retina. That is a superstition. It's not true, but it was in the context of those times, people did think that was a possibility.
With this case, this brought up, again, confessions, and they thought they had the culprit at one point or some points. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there was this really weird minister who confessed to the crimes. He went in and he heard about it. I think he was from a neighboring town and he liked to ride the trains and whatnot. And he muttered a few things on the train to make people think that maybe he had something to do with it. And he went in and managed to get himself into the house while it was still being under investigation, which wasn't uncommon in those days. People tramped through murder scenes all the time. So he did get himself into the house so he could see things, which of course means that if he's not the killer but he wants to confess, he would have seen the layout and seen where everything had happened and heard law enforcement talking and whatnot. This also was really way before anybody from the FBI, for example, would have known what to do with something like this. It's a very unusual kind of crime in a town that's relatively quiet where they really don't have much in the way of law enforcement that knows how to do murder investigations. So anyway, so this guy, interesting kind of psychology, are people who will falsely confess to things. And we've seen that a few times in our own time, like the guy,
sure,
John Mark Carr, who wanted to be the one who killed JonBenet Ramsey, even though he wasn't anywhere near the place at the time. There are people who like to associate themselves with sensational crimes. And sometimes it's because they feel guilty over something else, or sometimes it's just because they get so excitable when something like this occurs that they just want to be part of it so much that they're willing to confess. Even when you have something like not just conviction but the death penalty in place, they still sometimes will falsely confess. We have a lot of research for that now to understand the mindset of somebody who might do that. But anyway, so he, you know, he was an odd guy. So that kind of made people realize maybe he's not for real. And there were things that he didn't get right, and he couldn't have been there at the time he said he was there, et cetera, that he was the primary suspect for a while, but then in the end, he wasn't the guy. But the fact that he confessed is so weird, and that continues to be something that people, investigate today.
And with this story, it doesn't end there, because you say there's another fan of the murders, a man named Andy Sawyer, and he also came under suspicion. And this is in 1917, so what happens with that? And then you talk about another confession, because it's not just one confession. And after that, so tell us about this.
Yeah, well, we actually have, when you have a famous murder, and this obviously became quite famous and sensational, you do get a number of confessions. I would suspect it wasn't just these two. I would think there's probably more that we just don't know about, because the Lindbergh kidnapping case, for example, had over 200 confessions. The Black Dahlia had quite a few confessions, even including a guy who hadn't even been born at the time she was killed. So,
right.
So what is it that drives people to falsely confess? Well, they get very obsessed with something. They're already mentally unstable in some odd way. And this guy, Andy Sawyer, that you mentioned, he'd purchased a newspaper with the headlines about the crime. So there we go. He sees the big, scary headlines. He liked to sleep with his axe, which is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's an odd habit. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think that's
a
very odd habit.
Yeah.
And then he would start to kind of mumble about the murders. He already was kind of an odd guy. So odd people often come under suspicion, as, you know, they're, you know, who knows what they're capable of doing, kind of thing. He got so involved, like after reading about it in the newspaper, got so involved that he actually would demonstrate reconstructions of how he think it might have happened, how the guy could have gotten away. So someone like that is actually a pretty viable candidate, because why is he trying to show people how this all took place and how the killer might have gotten away? But
sure.
There really wasn't any evidence at all. Now, I'm not going to say he's not the guy, but there wasn't anything that linked him to it aside from his own kind of his ruminations about it.
But then you talk about a Reverend J.J. Burris from Oklahoma. He testified before a grand jury that he'd heard a confession in 1913 from a young blacksmith in Montana. Nothing came of that.
Yeah, and that's similar to this whole confession thing. I mean, the Lizzie Borden thing, the maid who had been in the Lizzie Borden house and her deathbed supposedly confessed that she knew what had happened and that Lizzie had been in it. And why did it take her so long? Well, part of it, the reason it took her so long is she had made a money deal. I mean, they had paid her off to say nothing. And then finally she wanted to tell it to a minister who then later wrote the story and said she had confessed to him. So why are people confessing so long afterward? Well, first of all we have is this report. We don't know that this person didn't confess earlier. He might have, and nobody took him seriously, or nobody reported it, or the reports were lost. So sometimes we get in the habit of thinking only documents we have access to, that's the whole of the story, when in fact we don't know that he didn't confess earlier. But even if he didn't, that wouldn't matter, because people do get very caught up in these kinds of cases. It's a mystery. People love solving them. People love having some association with them. I mean, we're having a lot of people now come out of the woodwork about, you know, I met Ted Bundy along the roadway or whatnot.
Sure.
And, you know, how many years has it been since Ted Bundy? And suddenly people are starting to say, hey, I knew him. You can get a book deal just saying you knew Ted Bundy, basically.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's an odd psychological thing that people get so attached to a particular story, and then in some way think they're either responsible or they know someone who is responsible. But in this case, nothing came of it. I mean, he said he heard a confession from a young blacksmith. Well, who was it? Where is he? What did he say? Anything specific, or was he just general? We don't know. We don't have details about it.
It continues with another confession as well. But do you talk about a officer that gets involved, McClowry, and he puts a pattern together of, you mentioned in other jurisdictions that there's similarities to other murders, and especially in the idea of covering up the bodies, covering up the windows, and the idea of the lamps. So tell us a little bit about just this pattern that he thinks he has, and then what he does with that assumption or that theory.
Okay, well, he's doing what we call linkage analysis long before, you know, behavioral profiling has ever even entered anyone's lips. So he's trying to figure out if these other axe murders in other jurisdictions, one's Colorado Springs where six were killed, and another is in Illinois, another one's in Kansas. There's actually several in Kansas. There were two in Kansas. There was one instance where it was two side-by-side houses, and both houses, everyone was killed. There were similarities there. So then that came from 1911 through 1912. And then he heard about this guy, Henry Lee Moore. And Henry Lee Moore is actually the person a lot of people think is the killer. I just saw it in another book that he definitely is the killer, even though there's nothing proven that he's the killer. But quite a few people believe that. I think it's on Wikipedia that way and whatnot. Anyway, so Moore had killed his mother and grandmother with an axe because he wanted to inherit the house because he had promised it to some woman that he had gotten involved with. So because he had used an axe, which, by the way, was very common in those days as a murder weapon. That wasn't in any way unusual. So because he had murdered with an axe, he was convicted. This McCloffrey decided that he had to be the guy. He knew that Moore had been had kind of wandered around and, you know, been in some of these other states. So if he could be tied to them, that would close 26 cases. The only thing is, it wasn't a very good linkage analysis because, really, the way Moore went about killing his mother and grandmother, I mean, first of all, he faked his name and he stayed in a hotel under a false name, and his whole approach to it wasn't like this sneaky entering at night and then exiting. There was very little in common between how he had actually killed his mother and grandmother and the way these other murders were carried out, aside from it being an axe. But McCloffrey was convinced, even though he couldn't get Moore to confess, he was convinced he had the right guy, and he tried to present this, but nobody in Villisca was interested, so nothing really happened with this case to tie it to Moore. Even though he had the same last name as the you know, J.B. Moore, the murder victim, they had no relationship to each other.
And you continue to write that there's other people, that the father-daughter author of sports, actual writer, decided to take upon this. And as you write in the book, come to conclusions that they shouldn't have come to and make assumptions. Tell us about what they ended up writing about.
Well, they actually kind of played off of what someone had done for the Smithsonian magazine, doing a different kind of linkage analysis and linking, and it wasn't to Moore, it was to, they had another suspect, Paul Mueller, and a fairly good suspect. It wasn't totally off base, but what ended up happening is, which I've seen before, is they began to think that almost every potential similarity had equal weight, which is a mistake that people make when they participate in what we call confirmation bias. You have an idea, and you just start looking for anything that'll support it, and it's very easy to see what you want to see when you've decided that this person who's riding the trains in fact went from one side of the country to the other over a period of quite a few years and ended up, you know, massacring a bunch of people. I can't remember how many they had, but it was a lot. And by the end of the book, I was like, everybody, who, aside from Lizzie Borden's parents, basically everybody killed with an axe seems to be linked together, even though there were dramatic dissimilarities But what happens with confirmation bias when you're doing linkage analysis is you have a hypothesis, and you begin to, that hypothesis puts weight on those factors that support your hypothesis and minimizes those factors that don't. And that's not really a fair way of doing a behavioral analysis. It's not based on real probability. It's based on you see things that you want to see. But you don't realize that's what you're doing because you're getting so excited about all these great connections you're making, and you've
right.
discovered one of the world's worst serial killers ever to behold. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I've seen that before, of people who just start going, wow, this guy was over here and over here and over here, and my God, he also killed John F. Kennedy and JonBenet Ramsey and the Black Dahlia and this and that.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
and at the, yeah. by the end of the day, when you're reading some of these accounts, it's like they have no stopgap measures. They have no real methodology. Their methodology is simply, wow, somebody killed with an axe. It wasn't very far from a railroad track. Let's put them into the mix without looking at the genuine and dramatic behavioral differences that would put that person out of the loop. And that's what I saw. Was, oh my God, there's so much going on here without seeing that the things that make it not work in your scenario are simply ignored or minimized for no particular reason. So that does happen when you get people who don't really have much experience in the criminal justice field, and they start getting very excited about their theory and wanting to show, wow, this is one of the biggest stories ever that no one's ever realized before. Well, the reason they haven't realized it before is because it just isn't all it's cracked up to be, according to the way you're looking at the data. So that's what I have to say about that.
When you looked at the linkage evidence, when you looked at some of the similarities in other states, what was your conclusion? I mean, you said that Adam Sawyer probably wasn't a bad suspect, but
well, I think
were you able to?
I think Adam Sawyer ended up being in a different town or something at mm-hmm. the time, with also no evidence. I mean, I don't know who it is, and I don't really speculate on who it is, but I do think that Villisca isn't an isolated incident because of certain very specific behaviors, being
right.
the handling of the glass, I don't know, what do you call that, the thing that's on top of the glass chimney. The handling of
right.
the glass
but.
Chimney is very, very odd and very specific. That would be what we call signature behavior, really distinct, really unusual. That you don't see in all of these, but you do see in a few, and they're neighboring states, like the couple in Kansas, I think, were probably linked. And I think McCloffrey's linkage is fairly good, so I would agree with him, except that he took it too far by
right.
deciding that Henry Lee Moore and the way he killed his mother and grandmother is similar to these other ones, and it isn't at all. So he did that same thing. Because it was an axe, he's good for these, and that isn't correct because his entire approach to killing his mother and grandmother was so distinctly different from these others that you have to consider, you know, that just because you want him to be the guy doesn't make him the guy. But I do think McCloffrey was correct in the fact that these were neighboring states, pretty close together, and I'm not sure I'd put I might not put the Illinois one in, but the ones in Kansas, Colorado, and Iowa, I think, were pretty good. But I don't really speculate as to who it could have been because it can so easily be somebody who never even got on the record at all. It could just be a you know, an anonymous person, just like Jack the Ripper could be. Maybe all the suspects that have been named, none of them is it.
What I found interesting for the time was that this signature of posing and displaying a victim that early was quite interesting.
What do you mean? I mean, displaying a victim is it has different purposes, but a lot of times that's sexual, and that, I mean, we've seen that, you know, into history. But what is it that you found interesting about it?
Well, it just that he had so many unique features in a signature for that. I don't know. I just attribute sort of the interesting and unique features to more modern serial killers.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the thing with the hunk of, I guess it was a pound of bacon or something sitting out was so weird. Mm-hmm. And then the something with the mirror was also odd. I can't recall exactly what it was. But it's clear this guy has mental health issues, not just because he's a mass murderer, but he's got some other kind of mental instability because he does have rituals and weird, seemingly weird superstitions. It looks as if he did a bit of sexual molestation in one of the girls in the Villisca house. But when he goes up, you know, and he seems to know the layout of the house, that's sort of peculiar too. He knows exactly who's where and what bedrooms. He goes right for the parents and, you know, murders them really fast. So there's definitely something odd about him and about those behaviors, which is what helps us to at least theoretically link them to some of those others in Kansas and Colorado, because the more peculiar a behavior is and shows up in something else, the more likely it is it's attributable to the same person. So we do have distinct ones there, but just because it's near a railroad track and an axe is used, that to me, that's MO. That's the method of operation.
Yeah.
That isn't signature.
Yeah. No. We're going to use this as an opportunity, Catherine, just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor. You know what's not smart? Job sites that overwhelm you with tons of the wrong resumes. But you know what is smart? ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't wait for candidates to find you. ZipRecruiter finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply. So you get qualified candidates fast. No more sorting through the wrong resumes. No more waiting for the right candidates to apply. It's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Catherine, another story in the book that's incredible, and I'd like to share it with the audience, is the story of the Gitche Girl.
Okay.
And this is in Gitche Manitou State Preserve in 1973, and five teens went out one autumn evening. Tell us about teens were doing in South Dakota in this Lyon County in this state preserve.
Well, I think when, you know, kids have nothing much to do, they find places where they can go hang out. They were just going to go kind of smoke some dope and listen to music and just hang out and do something instead of stay home and do nothing.
Sure.
And as they set up, they got firewood, they had a campfire, and they start to sing, and their music attracts some guys who are actually in that area illegally poaching or trying to poach. I guess they didn't do a very good job that day. And they decided, okay, you know, this, at least according to the way this reconstruction is, because who knows what actually happened, but they decide to have a little fun, and it gets out of hand. It was just ugly right from the start. They came down. It was three brothers. They threatened the kids, shot one of them right away, and the rest of them took off. And these are like, you know, 13, 14, 15. They're young kids. They don't know what this is about and why anybody is accosting them like this. And then they make them, they shoot another and wound him. And they make them go back up to where their van is, or their car, and where these brothers' truck is. And there they shoot the boys. I mean, this is essentially a mass murder site. And they take the girl. What was her name? Sandra, I think her name was.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
take her for basically a ride over the border into where around where they live, and then eventually bring her back, drop her off, and she has no idea that her friends are dead. She says. Because they had assured her, oh, you know, they're not really dead. They're, you know, we hit them with darts or whatever. They'll be okay. And so she believes that, and she doesn't realize that, you know, the families of these boys are looking for them, and she's the only survivor. So when the bodies are found, of course, she's told. And the sheriff wants to talk to her. Well, you know, how is it that you survived and they all got killed?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what makes it such an astonishing story, because she also doesn't have the answer to that question. Also, does she know where they took her? Well, sort of. I mean, it wasn't like, again, she's 13. Who's paying attention? It's also night. Who's paying attention?
Right.
She's scared. She's traumatized. Trauma does a lot of stuff to memory. But bizarrely enough, she thinks she sees the place. I mean, the sheriff is doing this a lot. It isn't just a one-hit wonder here. He keeps taking her out to see if something comes back, and eventually she thinks she sees a place, because she does remember some key things about it when the one brother she was with had stopped, and at that point, that he drives by in the truck.
Yeah.
So they got him. What a bizarre coincidence. So another
yeah.
aspect of the Gitche thing is just that happened, because it could easily have been that she just never was able to, you know, definitively say this is the place, but they did get him. They got all three of them.
Yeah.
It was a horrible
crime. What we failed to, I think, explain to the audience is that they realized when they were playing the guitar and singing, these kids were smoking pot. So they realized, okay, we're
right.
going to have a little bit of fun. He went back to tell his brothers, and then they posed as police officers. So Sandra, at age,
right.
and all of the boys believed that they were police officers. And then when Sandra was taken away from them, she saw the boys alive and just thought that
right.
they were all going to be reprimanded and said, see ya on Monday. Thought she'd get in a little bit of trouble. And then you
yeah.
write that the nightmare isn't over for her once she says she notices this red gasoline tank, and then
mm-hmm.
the farmhouse was nearby. So she does do this incredible, she was able to help the police locate them. And like you say, just out of a movie, just very movie-esque,
mm-hmm.
the one person that brought her home that was about to rape her, as you write in the book.
Right.
Was about to rape her, decided to bring her home, I guess foolishly now, he drives by in that same blue truck, as you say,
yeah.
coincidences of all coincidences. So,
but there are definitely
now, what,
people who didn't believe her story.
Yeah.
And that's because it does sound very far-fetched, especially that now the brothers, yeah, it was about getting the pot in a way, but also because they were so upset that they had invested so much time and were coming back empty-handed. So for them, it was, well, we're going to get something out of this trip. The fact that one of those brothers with that kind of attitude would actually have this girl alone and not rape her, I think I think people just didn't believe that. And
yeah.
I find it hard to believe, too, because it's not like these guys had any any moral center or anything. So why would he have done that? I'm not sure. I don't know that we do have the whole story here.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about Sandra's PTSD, and you talked about just what happened after in terms of people not believing her. So she dropped out of school and got married, but this did not leave her, this stink of guilt did not leave her ever, did it?
Right, and it isn't even, I mean, they blamed her, like, as if somehow she had attracted these guys. And
mm-hmm.
because of her, if only she hadn't been with them, they would still be alive, which is absurd. Nobody knows if that's the case or not. And it's not as if, I mean, who knows? She might have been singing along and maybe they heard a girl's voice and said, oh, there's a girl down there. Let's get her. Maybe that's true, but we don't know that that's true. But she was blamed. She was ostracized. And it did certainly affect her for a long time.
You have, in this book also, you talk about Iowa in a certain position in terms of position, basically, in America, where it has been an important place for serial killers such as John Wayne Gacy, and you mentioned other serial killers. Let's talk about Iowa's importance to John Wayne Gacy.
Okay. Well, Gacy had gotten married and was working in Iowa. Let me see if I can find that. I can't remember the exact town, but let me see if I can find it. He was working there, and this is the first place where he begins to molest boys. So it's
mm-hmm.
kind of the start of a criminal life, but also it's the start of his ability to persuade people that he's a good guy. And you know, he's very civic-minded. He's very involved in stuff. His father-in-law thought he was just going to be a loser, so now he's proving himself by being invited into several things and, you know, like Lions Clubs and whatnot. So he uses these, positions, you know, some status to invite boys over and, you know, offer them liquor and drugs and whatnot to, you know, show how cool he is. But at the same time, he's using it to get some of the boys into compromised positions so he can molest them. And he manages to succeed, apparently, with some, but others turn on him. And this is the first point at which he gets arrested and he goes to trial and he's convicted and he actually gets a prison sentence for doing this. This is in Iowa. So the interesting thing is it became a big deal after he was unmasked as a serial killer in Chicago because he had gotten a 10-year sentence, but he was let out after just over 2 years. And he had kind of this record wasn't secret. It wasn't locked away, but states didn't have much to do with each other's jurisdictions. And
right.
But somebody does find out he's got a record. You know, when Rob Peast was really, the disappearance of a boy named Rob Peast was really what started
right.
that in Chicago. And they start looking into his past, into Gacy's past, because Gacy appeared to be the last person to have seen him when he supposedly was offering him a summer job in construction. There was no reason why Rob Peast would have run away. There was every reason to believe he'd stay. He was about on his way home. And so somebody really started looking into Gacy because he already was at the center of a number of other young men's disappearances, all of which he was able to explain away. And in part, he acquired this talent in Iowa, being able to talk his way through these things and to say, you know, that he's a good guy. How could anybody suspect him of doing anything bad? He's you know, a family man. He's well-placed in the community. Does the same thing in Chicago. I mean, he's politically well-connected. He's got a thriving construction business. He dresses like a clown to go entertain sick kids. In my mind, that's enough to call him a serial killer personally,
yeah.
but that's just me. Any rate, so then they look back and find out he does, in fact, have a prison record, and it is for molesting boys. Now they have real reason to be worried about Rob Peast, and some of these other boys and young men who've disappeared. So now they're really taking it seriously, and they're putting surveillance on him, and that eventually breaks the case. But he got his start in Iowa doing this stuff.
You also say, too, the stay in Iowa after he was convicted and he made a decision before he went to Chicago that he was going to do things differently, didn't he?
Well, yeah, and that's something we see commonly in sex offenders who get caught, convicted, and a prison sentence is when they do get out, they decide there will be no witnesses. So now it's not going to just be about molesting them. They have to die, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a story in this book, the namesake of the book, it's called Heartless, and the story is called Heartless with Brian Hatman and his mistress, Sydney Goodrich Rutledge. Very, very interesting story. Tell us about this.
That's funny.
It truly is a heartless.
I think that's funny. I thought the most weird story in the book was the weird suicide.
Absolutely.
The quadriplegic suicide.
Well, let's talk about that then. That's, yeah.
I mean, I can talk about Byron Hatman. It's a classic love triangle. It's very similar to one I wrote about when I did the Michigan one, which became a Jimmy Stewart movie, The Anatomy of a Murder.
Right.
It's very similar to that because we have a woman who is kind of, you know, her husband's a workaholic. And he's older than her. Let's see, his name is Byron Hatman. And so let me get my name straight. So Byron Hatman moves from Pennsylvania to St. Louis, to work in St. Louis, and they go to Cedar Rapids. His wife is Sydney, and she is younger than him, and she has a master's degree, and she's, you know, sexy and restless, and so she starts looking around to have some fun while her workaholic husband is you know, just not around. She wants to play, and she meets a guy who has a boat or a yacht, and he brings her to the yacht club, and she starts really flirting with him, and then the story gets very, very strange because she ends up getting pregnant. She claims she was raped. Again, it's very similar to that story in the Upper Peninsula. Claims she was raped. So her husband now has to do the right thing, and it's a strange story because of the way the constant back and forth between the two men. Her husband thinks he's got to, you know, do the right thing and defend her honor and whatnot, but he doesn't really have to do anything. That's the bizarre thing. He doesn't really have to act. The other guy moves away and he's working, you know, in a different town altogether. But Sydney's husband can't let it go. So. I'm not sure where you want me to go with this. To me, it's a typical love triangle gone bad and with a lot of misunderstandings that ends in murder. You know, and a murder I think didn't have to take place just because it was so weirdly arranged and organized. But I'm not sure why, what it is you're wanting to go after with this story.
I just thought it was just the namesake of the book, and it really does. I mean, it doesn't encapsulate anything more than just it really was heartless, and that what she had done to the husband, when she's discovered, she never owns up to anything at all, and the poor guy ends up killing this person for the wrong, like you say, the wrong reason. It could have been avoided. It was his own, I guess, sense of pride, and then at the end, he even leaves a note, a pathetic note, too, that just forget about him and move on, and she'll have a bright future. So it's, again,
so the husband, Rutledge, would said that they were constantly being harassed, although they weren't. there was some kind of, there were hints that there was a extortion. You know, if you'll pay me, I'll leave you alone. So Rutledge was going over there supposedly to pay him, and then Hatman ended up dead, fatally stabbed. So the whole thing was so bizarre the way it happened. Yet it is considered, I think because it was kind of a high society one, it was considered a real classic Iowa crime. And a lot of the stuff that I saw about it, you know, people talked a lot about it. And I think because it does fit in that kind of noirish atmosphere of you know, flirtatious married women who lead a man on, and the man, you know, goes ahead and gets involved with them. So to me, it was a pretty typical kind of story like that. But it was sad because of the way it ends, obviously. And I think so much of what happened was easily avoided. But she, you know, in part it was about her. And she didn't want to own up to the take responsibility for her own behavior. So part of it was really about her. And she, in the end, I think she's the only one who kind of survived and thrived out of it in a way.
You talk about the story of Glenn Beck, and it is truly a bizarre story. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is weird because I do a lot with suicidology. And I, when I came across this story, I just thought it seemed so outlandish. So Glenn Beck, who had an association with the police department, he calls the sheriff's office in the county where he lives, and he reports that his wife has killed herself. Now, the weird thing is, she's a quadruple amputee. So what?
Yeah.
How does a person do that? And it is bizarre. First of all, how she got to be a quadruple amputee has to do with the fact that she had a tendency to get very depressed. And one day in the middle of winter, so here we have that whole heartland, the harsh winters kind of tone to this. Mm-hmm. So she just went out, you know, without any protection. They ended up finding her, and she had frozen, but she was still alive, but she lost her arms and legs. So here she, not a good way to cure depression by any means. So now she's back in the house. He's caring for her, but it's obviously quite a burden. He does have people come, you know, nurses and whatnot come in and check on her. And at one point, he had found her. Somehow she managed to maneuver her way out of bed, and it isn't just out of bed and across the floor. She has to go out of bed, down a step, and up and whatnot. But she had maneuvered her way over to the table where the medications were and pulled with her teeth on the tablecloth to pull the medications down because she was trying to overdose. He got her back into bed, according to his story, but that incident showed that it was possible that she had committed suicide. So what we have here is probably an assisted suicide, I'm guessing. Again, here she is. He had left the medications on the table. They, without the caps on, he said accidentally. That part to me is, that isn't any accident because he already knows she has done this before. But it's clear she wants to die. It's clear to him she wants to die. And also, he's got other ideas for his life. He's not going to want to do this his whole life. But anyway, so he finds her having accomplished this again, without arms and legs, got herself off the bed, across the floor, down the step, over to the table, pulled the tablecloth with her teeth, and there's apparently water there so that supposedly the medication had dissolved into the water. Okay, what a far-fetched story. You know, I don't believe that for a second. But so supposedly, you know, she just lucked out and it had dissolved, and so she's able to lap it up and die from an overdose. Wow, what a weird, bizarre story. You know, and it doesn't end there because, you know, they find out he's involved with another woman, and so now it looks like it's potentially murder. But the fact that he's in this compromised position and he's also associated with law enforcement, one of the DAs who would have used him feels like, well, I can't use him at all. And he's the one who insists there needs to be an investigation of this incident. But the other DA, so that the weird part is the jurisdiction issues. The other DA doesn't know, you know, I accept the story. I'm not going to press charges. So then the Iowa attorney general gets involved, and he also thinks, oh, you know, any inconsistencies we have here, and there were quite a few, by the way, any inconsistencies mm-hmm. are just misstatements, and we're just going to leave it as a suicide. We're not going to do anything about this. And so it really, again, it does remain a bit of a mystery because there were inconsistencies. He said at one point it sounded like there was some kind of like a squawking in the background when he was on the phone with someone. He said it was his peacock. Long before there were comfort peacocks, by the way, he said it was his peacock, and that was weird. He claimed that one of the people, the aides who came in, had not come in. She said, yes, she had. So there were a lot of inconsistencies in his statements, and I think it's pretty clear that he definitely made sure if she wanted to die, she could accomplish it. But I also think he probably helped her along a bit as well. But I think it was such a strange story. The idea that a person with no arms and legs could commit suicide is just so out there. And I just had to have this for this book because who's ever heard of something like that?
What I found odd was that they actually could get a nurse to say, well, a couple months earlier, or to someone to testify that, that she had done this before, this lapping up the drugs.
Right.
You know, that was the most incredible part of the story, and yet they had somebody to say that this had happened before. I thought that was incredible. You also write that because he had a dual, he was a police chief, or he had a role in one jurisdiction, and in another county he was a police chief. And in that other county, it didn't sit well with him, and he wrote letters to all kinds of officials trying to get this case at least to be prosecuted or looked into further, but he failed, didn't he?
Yeah, because the county where it would have had to have been open, they said no, we're accepting it. So did they know something? You wonder. Because I think there are plenty of good reasons why something like this should have been reopened. Just some of the odd contradictions. Why not go through and really do an investigation? But you know what? I've seen that kind of investigation in my own state where it's so obvious this needs to be further explored, but they just don't want to.
And, you know, to add even more credibility to what you're saying, this man married his alleged mistress as well, just if you're talking motive at all.
We had plenty of motive. I mean, first of all, what a burden. First of all, he's got a woman who's so depressed she wants to die, and she walks out the door one day, and they find her in the ditch, you know, frozen. Now he's got to deal with, you know, paying for help to come in, worrying about, you know, someone's got to come in and turn her, feed her, do all kinds of stuff. So his life became a nightmare, and then he, you know, gets involved with someone else, and now he sees a way out, but that way out is not going to happen unless, you know, his wife is allowed to go ahead and do what she wants to do. In his mind, I'm sure it seems justified. How involved he was is not clear, but it is pretty clear that he knew what was going to happen, wanted it to happen, and did some help along the way.
And it does seem incredible, like you say, that the authorities would not prosecute, would not convene a grand jury, would not look at this. It looked like he was getting a pass.
Yeah, and I think what would have happened is her history of depression, her earlier suicide attempt, her telling
yeah.
people she wanted to die. I think all of that would have come in and very likely been, you know, pretty persuasive.
Yeah, and you could be right, too. The prosecutor just could have said, this has got too many,
yeah.
it's very, very difficult, so it might be not worth prosecuting. So.
Yeah, it's one of those cases right on the edge. It's like the tennis ball on the net. Which side is it going to be on? And I think a prosecutor would see, oh my God, this is going to be so full of holes either way, that it's going to be difficult
yeah.
to take this on.
Yes. I want to thank you, Catherine, for coming on and talking about Heartless. How many stories are in this Heartless collection?
I actually didn't count. It looks like there's a good dozen. 1, 2, 3, 4,
mm-hmm.
5, 6. Yeah, about that. Each of the books
yeah.
has about that many stories. I mean, the fun is that you're really trying to get the character of the state that you're writing about. So you want to really
mm-hmm.
get a central story, but the others have to radiate around that same theme. Some of the states I had lived in and was familiar with. Iowa is not one of those, but I did know the Villisca case pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And what is the next installment of Notorious that you'll be involved with?
I don't know.
I did
13 so far. I haven't actually talked to Greg about the next one. He has a number of them. Like Caitlin Rother has done a few, and Kevin Sullivan
mm-hmm.
has done a few, and Greg has done a few. So I don't even know where it is at this point. I think all the good states are kind of taken. I wanted Utah and California, but I think somebody's already working on them. And Greg did Oregon, where I had lived once. So I'm not really sure. I'd have to look at what's left to see what I want to do.
Ah, there you go. But there's 13 so far. Yeah.
There's 13 in my collection, yes.
Yes, absolutely. For those fans that might just want to take a look at, do you have a website or a Facebook page? Tell us about that, Catherine.
It's Facebook. I kind of let my website go because the amount of time
mm-hmm.
it took to work on it, I wanted to use to write. So mostly
yeah.
I do Facebook. I have a one for me. I have a Fans of Catherine Ramsling page, and I have my personal page. Any of those people can get on easily and see what I'm up to.
Well, thank you very much, Catherine. It's been a pleasure, as it always is, talking about Notorious USA Iowa. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
You have a great evening.
Thanks for your interest. Bye.
Thank you. Good night.